was monasticism in quite a different form. And of course, Francis had the idea simply of a group of poor people working and helping others and not trying to accumulate anything for themselves. And it became changed by the cardinals who took an interest in him, and by the later pope, into an organization to advance the church and to be the pope's emissaries all over. And so his followers, some of them had his original ideal, many of them. Some of them had the ideal of spreading the knowledge of the gospel. There were doubtless many of them who truly were trusting in Christ and to whom all else was more or less incidental. The numbers varied from time to time. Then there were doubtless those who saw the privileges that the friars received and how all over Europe at first they were received with such fine approbation and who took advantage of it. I expect that all of you at some time or other have read Scott's Ivanhoe. And in Scott's Ivanhoe, you remember how Black Knight came to the little hut in the forest where a friar Tuck was, and while they had an evening of singing and of frivolity together there. And Ivanhoe and Scott gives there, put into the mouth of King Richard, who was in disguise, the song about the Crusades, the two songs. And then he gives a song which he says that the friar sang. And it is very interesting in the connection with what we're just speaking about. It is called the Barefooted Friar, which Scott says, so saying, he reached his harp and entertained his guests with the following characteristic song to a sort of derry-down chorus appropriate to an old English ditty. The Barefooted Friar. I'll give thee, good fellow, a 12-month or twain to search Europe through from Byzantium to Spain. But ne'er shall you find, should you search till you tire, so happy a man as the Barefooted Friar. Your knight for his lady pricks forth in career and is brought home at evensong quick through with a spear. I confess him in haste, for his lady desires no comfort on earth save the Barefooted Friar. Your monarch, saw many a prince has been known to barter his robe for our cowl and our gown, but which of us e'er felt the idle desire to exchange for a crown the gray hood of a friar? The friar has walked out, and wherever he's gone, the land of his fatness is marked for his own. He can roam where he lists, he can stop when he tires, for every man's house is a barefooted friar. He's expected at noon, and no white till he comes may profane the gray chair or the porridge of plums. For the best of the cheer and the seat by the fire is the undenied right of the barefooted friar. He's expected at night, and the pasty's made hot. They broach the brown ale and they fill the black pot. And the good wife would wish the good man in the mire ere he lacked the soft fellow, the barefooted friar. Long flourish the sandal, the cord and the colt, the dread of the devil and trust of the pope. For together life roses unscathed by the briar. Is granted alone to bear for his trial. Now that's a poem which Scott puts into the mouth of this man there, doubtless represents the privileges which many of these men who would have had a life perhaps of poverty, perhaps of very great effort to accomplish little in the miseries and hardships of the Middle Ages, found the joys they found in this life of the wandering friar. It certainly was not characteristic of the order as a whole in its early days, but it was characteristic of the privileges that they received when they were welcomed so by Europe as something new and something that seemed so wonderful. And all of them seemed to be at first carrying on the spirit and attitude of St. Francis. And however, you can well imagine, as time went on, and some proved to have entered the order just for this sort of privileges, people turned against them. And there were many parts of Europe where they were, people had considerable dislike of them. So they dared not do anything against them because they were under the direct protection of the court. And then, too, the two orders, the Franciscans and Dominicans, became great rivals. And in the university, they began to struggle as to which of them would get a man into a certain chair. And there came to be, at times, great rivalry between them, even though others made, the popes made great efforts to have them work together and generally succeeded. And so that their efforts were largely for the advancement of the popes rather than against each other. And yet there were times when the rivalry between the two orders broke out into real hatred. Incidentally, it is very interesting that a few years ago at least, the average Protestant thought of Protestantism as many different sects and groups, but that the Roman Catholics were absolutely united, one great united group. And it is interesting when one thinks of that to realize that back in 1774, when the King of Spain announced the Jesuits, the strongest order in the Roman Church, were to be expelled from Spain and all its dominions, and they were put out of Mexico and South America, allowed to carry each man only one book and the clothes on his back. When that order was announced in the court of Spain, the Franciscans and the Dominicans clapped and cheered in praise for it. And the Roman Church has been broken up into many little groups with differences among them and great controversy and opposition among them, and is to this day. And it speaks for the careful dealing and the clever handling of the associates of the Pope that they have been able to hold them together and to make them vie with one another in statements of loyalty to the Pope and in efforts to carry out the main thing that he desired. However, another interesting thing in this connection is the papal theory, or the Roman theory as understood by many, that the Pope is the head and he administers right straight down and the orders come from the top. Of course, it was utterly different in the early days when the leaders in every church were selected by the people of that church. But the idea that there is an administration from the top, often that works for efficiency in various regards. And yet, in the end, it can be destructive. You remember how the Pope, while he did send St. Augustine to England, and he won England for the Pope, he sent a man to Ireland, and the man gave it up as an impossible task, and Patrick went there, whom the Spirit of God had raised up without any authorization from the Pope, and he had a tremendous career in Ireland. It's most interesting to go to St. Peter's Church in Rome today, the largest church in the world, and you go in there and see these tremendous statues all around, and these monuments of every sort. There's a statue of St. Peter, which is a little more than life-size, on a pedestal which the big toe has been almost completely removed by, because it's been kissed by so many thousands through the ages. And you see these other statues around, but up on the wall around there are about 10 or 12 niches. And in these niches there are statues maybe double life-size, great statues of great leaders of the church. And not one of these statues is a statue of a pope. And not one of them is a statue of a man who was originally appointed to anything by a pope. But all of them are the statues of men who founded orders, such as St. Francis and St. Dominic and the founder of the Jesuit order. And most of those men, like Francis and Dominic and Loyola, had an idea for which they worked and struggled and then went to try to get the approval of the Pope and found it difficult to get. And had, if it hadn't been for Pope Innocent III's dream that he referred to a couple of times, one wonders whether he would even have given his approval to Francis and to Dominic. But some of his cardinals saw how they could be used, and the Pope also saw that in the situation that he needed all the help he could to maintain it as it was, and they had wisdom enough to support these men. If they had taken a similar attitude towards Peter Walsall, it is most likely the Waldensians could have been incorporated into their structure. But at that time, they did not show a similar wisdom. Of course, the case of the Albigenses is different, because the Albigenses were definitely unchristian in many of their views, even though on the whole men are people of high morality and people professing allegiance to the Bible. I think you could parallel to some extent, though they are quite different, you could parallel the Albigenses with the Mormons of today. The Mormons of today are on the whole people of high morality and of generally high standards. They are people of great devotion to what they believe. And they call themselves the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. And their people are very devoted to their teaching, to their doctrine, and most of their young people take 2 years at their own expense to go as missionaries. I've met them in Germany, I've met them in South America. Fine young men working hard to spread the doctrines of Mormonism and to begin Mormon churches. But their beliefs are very removed from those of true Christianity in many points. Perhaps not quite as far as those of the Albigenses were, but almost as far. And so the Pope rightly felt that the Albigenses were a tremendous menace to Christianity in Europe. They felt that very clearly. The Albigenses movement had the southern third of France almost completely in its hands, and it had it was gaining all over Europe. But of course, we cannot for an instant condone the measure that the Pope took in attacking the Albigenses, gathering an army to fight and destroy them, and killing thousands of them and reducing southern France to an utter desert. That certainly is not the Lord's will for his people, to use that means of study as his teaching today. But I think even worse than that is what they did later. If we would want to speak of that in our next head, just one more word about the friars. We notice how the friars were received with such approbation, but as time went on, there were others who spoke strongly against them, and along with the criticism of the fact that many groups of them fell into sin, fell into immorality, fell into utter worldliness, there is this to be remembered, that the fact that they could come into any region and could represent the Pope and could pay little attention to the bishop and the local clergy tended to make these people sometimes very jealous of them and arouse the hatred of them on their part. And so as that enters to some extent into it. But the one factor that we must remember about them is that it did introduce ecclesiastics into the area of education far beyond what they had been before. We noticed in the previous century great scholars like Anselm and the author Peter Lombard, the author of the celebrated Book of Sentences, but these were rare. Francis himself had no interest in education. He thought education made a person proud, and he rather was tended to oppose it. Dominic, of course, wanted education, wanted his men to spread their belief by preaching and by argument, by discussion. But as the Franciscan movement went on, it was turned into an institution which had tremendous interest in doing the very thing the Dominicans were doing. And so, within a very few years, against great opposition on the part of some of the universities at first, they gained their way into them to such an extent that most of their leading professors were either Dominicans or Franciscans. Now, our capital D is the Inquisition. And terrible as was the so-called crusade against the Albigenses, the Inquisition, which was then established by Pope Innocent III, was even worse. There are very few people today know much about that. We think of the Inquisition in connection with Protestantism. Or you think of it in connection with the Jews against whom it did terrible things. But we must remember, the Inquisition did not do, never did anything against a man who was openly a Jew. The Inquisition was directed against those who were Jews in heart while claiming to be Christians. Of course, in Spain, many Jews were forcibly baptized. And then if after that they were proven to be practicing, to be failing to eat pork, or to be failing to work on Saturday, or something else that suggested they had Jewish attitude, thousands of them later on were burned at the stake. We think of the Inquisition in connection with these two, the opposition to Protestantism, which it completely wiped out in Spain shortly after the Reformation began, and its opposition to those who they said were Jews at heart, which came just before the Reformation. But both of those are at least 200 years ahead of the place we are now. The Inquisition began as a measure against the Albigenses. It began right after the Albigensian Crusade, though there were traces of similar activities before. But right after this, it was established by the Pope, and it was made a definite procedure. Then the Dominicans were ordered by the Pope, in most cases, to take charge of and direction of the Inquisition. And the Inquisition went into all the countries of Europe, particularly in France, where the Albigenses had been strongest, and sought out any who had Albigensian tendencies. And the Inquisition, as it was worked out by these ecclesiastics then, was one of the most wicked and unchristian things that the world has ever seen. Most Roman Catholic books today will blame it on the kings of Spain and say the kings of Spain were using it for their own political power and would not let the Pope interfere with it when he wanted to moderate it. Well, that may be true at certain parts of it in connection with the Jews in Spain. It may have been true at certain times. But 200 years before that could possibly have been true, the Pope introduced it against the Albigenses. And as it was ordered to be carried on, and as it was carried on in these countries, the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica gives a very full and clear picture of its activities and of its principles. Now, I haven't checked in later editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica, but we had a salesman here one day for the Encyclopedia Britannica a few years ago, and this being a religious institution, he was anxious to have me realize how responsive we are to religious interests. So he told me that one of their editions had had an article on the Jesuits, which the Roman Catholics did not like, and so the editors had said to I suppose it was the Archbishop of Chicago, I don't know, it said, you look it over and tell us what you don't like and we'll change it to suit you. And so by this time, whether that article's even in, I don't know. But in the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, there is this long article on the Inquisition, which describes its activities in the century we're now looking at, 200 to 250 years before it was used by the kings of Spain against the Jews, and 300 years before the Protestantism began. And it describes it and explains how these men were sent by the Pope, made inquisitors of different areas in Europe, particularly in southern France, but also in Spain, in Germany, and in other countries, and in northern Italy, particularly, too. And these men went in there with full authority to seize anyone and try him. And the rules of the Inquisition did not permit the man to even hear his accuser. The accusation was given in private, that is, without the accused being present. He might be told the name of his accuser, but that was all. And if he were to claim that people, his enemies, will bring up charges against him, they would ask him right out a list of your enemies, without telling him who the accuser was. But he had no right to call witnesses. Anybody who appeared as a witness for him would become suspect himself. No lawyer dared defend a man accused by the Inquisition. He himself would then prove himself heretical if he did so. And if the man was proven to be and hold Albigensian views and stood by them, he then was burned at the stake. If he, under fear, said that he has gave up the view and turned away from them, then he would be imprisoned for life. And the prison, little cells, ridden with vermin and terrible food given, it was almost worse than death, the punishment given. However, the popes were very definite in saying that the inquisitors must not take life. The inquisitors they tortured the men, and they would even torture the witnesses to make them testify against them. Terrible tortures, but they never took life. The inquisitorial courts never killed anybody. They would simply say, deliver you to the secular court. And then the secular court had to have them burned. And if they didn't, they themselves were seized by the Inquisition. So that while nominally they always went through the forms of having no responsibility for death, it was a very terrible thing. No wonder that at about 1230, the leading inquisitor in Germany was seized by a mob and murdered, because so many of them had relatives whom they felt had been wrongly treated in this way. And this had continued off and on for 300 years at the time of Martin Luther. It gives you an idea of the bravery of the man when he stood up for what he believed to be right, knowing that he would almost certainly would himself be burned at the stake, and he surely would have been if it had not been that God used political conditions in the most remarkable way to protect him step by step. And finally, the emperor took over the whole area, but Luther had died a year before. And when he did, they demanded that he dig up Luther's body, but Emperor Charles V said, "I fight with the living, not with the dead," and refused to do so. But the Inquisition often dug up people's bodies who were convicted after their death, which was done even with John Wycliffe, the great leader of the originator of the English Reformation. Well, we won't go further into details of the Inquisition now. Yes?
The Inquisition,
it was either Innocent III or one of the next one or two popes right after him. I think that Innocent III suggested it, but it was actually instituted after his death. It would be between the Albigensian Crusade came to an end in 1514 and 1214 and 1216 when Innocent died. It would be within the next 10 years. It was before 1222 that it was instituted. Now we go on to E, to a more pleasant subject. Scholars of the 13th century. Scholars of the 13th century. And the 13th century is the great century of Roman Catholic scholarship. And it is a century in which there were many who were great scholars and who did work which is some of it still widely studied today. These men were all Franciscans or Dominicans. We notice the schoolmen of the previous century, when the movement known as, which we now call Scholasticism, began. Scholasticism, we notice, has a bad name today because there have been those in recent years who have picked out some of the silly subjects that some of the schoolmen argued about. As they'll always tell you, they argue about how many angels could dance on the point of a needle. I imagine that is some satirist imagination that they ever argued on such a subject as that. But we do find discussions in the works of St. Thomas Aquinas on the question, can two angels occupy the same spot at the same time? And questions like that. They did take up all sorts of questions about all sorts of scholastic matter. And they spent much time arguing about trivial things, but this would be a comparatively small part of their activity. On the whole, they were men who had a very considerable intellect and who worked very hard and who had a tremendous influence on their age. And they did a great deal that still is of value today. And this ridiculing of them the way it is done today, I can easily imagine that 200 years from now, someone could take our leading scientists of today and could take a fifth or a sixth of the things they discussed about, and they would look just as silly to somebody then as the part of what the schoolmen did that is ridiculed today. And if they have a particular prejudicial reason to do so, that may very easily be the case 200 years from now. But they have given people as a whole a false impression of these schoolmen, some of whom were very earnest Christian men, and all of whom, those who were specifically called these schoolmen, were men of great intellect and men of great diligence. The principal advantage that we have over them today is that we have adopted the experimental method, and we have put an emphasis on the experimental method, which did not enter into the thinking of most of these men. However, it did very markedly enter the life of the first of these whom we will look at. I mention him first simply because he chronologically comes at the very beginning. This is number one man, Roger Bacon. Roger Bacon lived from 1214 to 1294. 1214 to 1294. But you see, he had a long life, but he had a rather miserable one in some ways. He was a man who was too far ahead of his time to get along well. If you're far ahead of your time and if you're outspoken, you're apt to have difficulty. And he was quite outspoken. He was born in England and studied at Oxford. And he went to Paris, studied there, and became a Franciscan. He spent more than 20 years in the study of the languages and science. He evidently had access to a considerable amount of money because he spent thousands of dollars in buying books. He went back to Oxford, and books, of course, in those days had to be copied by hand, so they would be far more expensive than today. He went back to Oxford, was there for a time, and then he was called back by his order to Paris and put into rather strict confinement for a time. But he had had a classmate in school who was now Pope, who was a friend of his and asked for copies of his writings. And in about 18 months, he wrote three extensive works. Then he went back to Oxford, and after 10 years in Oxford, he was again placed in confinement by the order for certain suspected novelties in his ideas. And eventually, the last 2 years before his death, he was again set free. He was a great student of the world as it is, and was observing and studying. And he was also a great student of languages, had a very wide knowledge. And he was way ahead of his time, so much so that many of his suggestions, which were in the direction of the experimental method and of real scientific study, brought him into severe criticism, and they resulted in his having been thus placed in confinement for long periods during his life. After his death, he was all sorts of stories about him spread as if he had been a sorcerer and a magician, and had been able to do a marvelous thing. And doubtless he had been able to do things that were beyond what most could do. He is sometimes said to have been the inventor of gunpowder, but it is now thought that that is not actually true. But he did have various theories in various areas of science, which were worked out and proven true later on. He was looked on as something of a renegade, and his books were laid aside and no attention paid to them practically after his death until within the last 100 years, when they have been printed and they have been found to contain a great deal of very excellent material, even though there also is material in them which was purely imaginary, and material which was simply passing on ideas that were common in his time. Today, people tend to place him in the same level with the great thinkers of that day. In his own day, he had a great influence on certain individuals, but his influence otherwise was not wide. Roger Bacon, then, is a man who is one of the real innovators of the world's history, but did not have a great influence in his own day. In English thought, we have two men named Bacon who were very prominent. Roger Bacon, and then Francis Bacon is 400 years later. And Francis Bacon, many think of as the founder of the experimental method. Actually, we find it clearly taught in Aristotle. But Francis Bacon did develop it very greatly. Sometime, if you want to read Macaulay's essay on Francis Bacon, I think it's worth anybody's reading for his influence and also for the defects of his character. But now we will go on to number two, who is Albertus Magnus. Now, these men tended to use Latin names. In English, of course, it would be Albert the Great. And he was the most learned and widely read man of the 13th century. He lived from 1193 to 1280. Thus, he succeeded very slightly in his years, Roger Bacon. We mention him second, though, because he's more closely related to the men who followed. He was originally from Germany, born in Bavaria, studied in Italy. He was a Dominican. He was a man who had a very wide influence, tremendous knowledge, and wrote on all the physical sciences and on various areas of theology, had many very good ideas, and had a great influence on his successors. He did not do anything which aroused opposition to him, as in the case of Roger Bacon. And he took a great interest in praising the Virgin Mary. There is no writer previous to the time of the Reformation who was quite so fulsome and elaborate in his praise of the Virgin Mary as was Albertus Magnus. And this, of course, spread his praise with the common people of the day, among whom the idea was beginning to be developed more of turning their adoration to Mary. Number three is a man who had an influence far greater than that of Albertus Magnus. To how great an extent he was in his life affected by having studied with Albertus Magnus and having had a great devotion to him, great loyalty to him, is hard to say, because I would say that for everyone who knows anything about Albertus Magnus today, there are 10 who know about his pupil. His pupil did not have as wide a knowledge as he did, but devoted himself more specifically to theology than Magnus did, and had a very acute mind for studying, for working out particular details of argumentation, and a style which is filled with arguments arranged in logical manner, and had a tremendous influence at that day and to this day. His name is Thomas Aquinas. He's named after the town from which he came, Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas lived from 1225 to 1274. And of all men between the ancient world and the Reformation, he has the greatest influence today. He was a Dominican. And shortly after his death, the Dominicans declared him to be the greatest of all the schoolmen, the greatest of scholars, and declared him to be the great teacher. There were points at which the Franciscans had strongly opposed him. On particular points of doctrine, they had opposed him very strongly. He did not go near as far as the Franciscans did in his adoration of Mary. He denied the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, for instance, which the Franciscans were trying to advance, and which was made into a dogma by Pope Pius IX in 1870, or 64, I forget, just about that period anyway. But Aquinas denied it, and he had some of the Franciscans rather opposed him, but eventually the Pope declared him to be the great Romanist teacher. And today all the Roman Catholic schools take Thomas Aquinas as a great authority on Roman Catholic doctrine. He is, today his doctrine, his philosophy is studied in all their schools, whether they be Franciscan, Jesuit, Dominican, or what they are. And many thinkers in the Romanist Church today delight in calling themselves Thomists, after Thomas Aquinas. I imagine that if you studied into his books a while, you would become interested in his dialectical method and might find it fascinating. I have to admit that to just glance into it and start reading a little, it is very difficult to get interested in. It is in a way like a mathematical table. The Encyclopedia Britannica has gotten out its series of the great books of the Western world. In that series, they have nothing by Calvin, nothing by Luther, but two whole volumes by Thomas Aquinas. And these two volumes represent only one of his writings. He had a number of books he wrote, but the one, the Summa Theologica, the summary of theology, this is the one which they print there in the two volumes. And he has a definite form in every article in which he gives a statement first. And the statement, as a rule, seems to be what he doesn't believe. And then he goes on and he states certain things against this statement. And then he states objection one, objection two, objection three, to the argument against it that he has given. And then he gives a general discussion, and then he ends up with an answer to each of the objections. And so he does not place in bold relief what he thinks anywhere in each of these articles, but he places it more in a negative way of what he feels not to be the case, but he argues against that, and he takes up a tremendous variety of subjects in the whole area of theology, taking up the main teachings of theology, presenting biblical truths, biblical evidences for them, and also philosophical evidences for them, and answering objections. He covers a very wide area in it, and it is easy to see how a person could become fascinated by this study. As I say, I've never looked into it enough to feel more than a certain boredom when I have looked into it. But I can easily imagine how one could, because of the rather mathematical manner of his presentation. And, of course, his language is very clear, but he packs so much together that it takes considerable effort to get really into it. Today, it is the great book of the Romanist Church today. Of scholarly books, there is none, no other, which has a fraction in the Roman Church of the attention that is given to the writings of Thomas Aquinas. He is said to have been very stout. According to the story, in the table in the monastery, they had to cut a big place in front of him to cut it out so that he could sit comfortably at the table. And there are various stories like this told about him. But he was a very popular teacher. He died suddenly at the age of 48. And Dante, who thought very highly of him, said that he had been poisoned. But Dante wrote a century or so afterwards, and there's no evidence from the time of anything like that having occurred. Albertus Magnus, recognizing his genius as a young man, said of Aquinas, he will be such a roaring in theology that he will be heard through all the earth. And he did indeed accomplish that. How's that? No, no, Magnus, this particular point of the alleged Immaculate Conception, that is that Mary was had a birth without sin, that she was entirely free from original sin. This was advanced by the certain of the Franciscans. It was a superstition which began and which was never an official view until the last century, till about a century ago. But this view, certainly the Franciscans were advancing, and he denied it. But whether Magnus even was familiar with this idea, I don't know. At least there's no evidence of any argument between the two of them on that. But Magnus, of course, greatly honored the Virgin Mary. I guess Aquinas was considerably too. But on this particular point, he denied, which the Franciscans were anxious to advance. Now, we must mention one of the great Franciscans, a man who is called Bonaventure, Bonaventure. He lived from 1221 to 1274. He died in the same year that Thomas Aquinas died. And Bonaventure was not his real name. His name was John Fidanza. He was born in Tuscany, but at the age of 4, he was very sick. And they thought he was going to die. And Francis of Assisi, who was then in the last 2 years of his life, prayed for the child, and they touched him, and the child began to show signs of recovery. And his mother explained, "Oh, Bonaventura, good fortune." And ever after that, they called the child Bonaventura, good fortune. And so that is what he is, the name that they called him all through his life. He was a great scholar, a very able thinker, but he was also a great practical man. He was the head of the Franciscan order. And he was a professor in Paris, and had considerable influence through his writing, but he was a very able, practical man, and he died in the same year that Thomas Aquinas did. The Franciscans in his life thought him a greater thinker than Aquinas, rather natural. Incidentally, we should mention that Peter Lombard, as we mentioned before, wrote a book of sentences, as he called it. And this book of sentences, written by Peter Lombard in the previous century, was a summary of theological view in the form of sentences or propositions. And this, for 2 centuries, was the great textbook of the Roman Church, was the sentences of Peter Lombard. And Bonaventura wrote a commentary on the sentences of Lombard, and so did Aquinas. They were commented on by dozens of writers, and they were published in many thousands of copies. But eventually, it was Aquinas' discussion which displaced the sentences of Peter Lombard. And I imagine that the Franciscans resisted that rather strongly, particularly when Bonaventura seemed to them to be as great or greater than Thomas. And maybe he could have been, if he had been as exclusively a scholar as Thomas was. But along with it, Bonaventura had his great activity in practical things and his administration of the Franciscan order. And so today, Bonaventura does not have anything like the recognition that Aquinas has. So in their own day, they were considered pretty much as on the same level. Number 5 is Duns Scotus. D-U-N-S, Duns Scotus. That is, he came from either Scotland or Ireland, so they called him Scotus. And his first name was D-U-N-S, and he lived from 1270 to 1308. He was a great thinker, but his mind was critical rather than destructive. And he opened many statements and questions to which Thomas Aquinas and others were supposed to have given final statements. He denied that many of the doctrines could be proved by reason. They came to call him the subtle doctor. And he does not have the same analytic precision and lucid statement as Thomas Aquinas and Peter Lombard, but he raised many vital questions and was very stimulating, but perhaps a little too much so for his day. He was one of the intellectual prodigies of history, but he died at the age of 40, and some of his arguments were so abstruse that people tended to just push them aside and say, oh, that's just what Dunce says. And so the name Dunce developed from his name. And to have our word dunce, which means an ignoramus, be derived for one who can't think, from a man who was one of the greatest men with the greatest critical acumen in thinking, is a queer irony of the development of language. But many of his statements were widely quoted in the next century or two. He never suffered such attack as Roger Bacon did, but his ideas were attacked often, very strongly, and some of his statements were quoted by those who were opposing those who were in the leadership in the next few centuries. His influence was largely critical rather than constructive, and Schaff says that with his death, the disintegration of scholastic theology begins. Well, now, this is the great century of the scholasticism, is this 13th century. I think the men of the 12th century we looked at are just as great as these. Anselm certainly is one from whom we can learn much. Anselm's understanding of the atonement and of its importance and of what it really meant was a tremendous step forward in theological understanding. And Anselm is one whom we can honor very highly. One reason for the scholastics of the 13th century having a greater fame, of course, is that there were more universities by this time. They were just being founded in the previous century, most of them. There was a wider diffusion of knowledge by the 13th century. And another reason, though, is that the writings of Aristotle were having a greater influence on their manner of presentation and on their thinking at various points. In fact, Thomas Aquinas definitely takes the great Greek philosopher Aristotle, who calls the philosopher, and he frequently refers to his authority on all sorts of matters. Two or three of Aristotle's works were known to the writers of the previous century. But in this 13th century, all of Aristotle's writings were available, though not in good translation. Because Aristotle was translated from Greek into Syriac. And then from Syriac it was translated into Arabic. And then it was carried by the Arabs across North Africa and up into Spain. And then in Spain they had it in Arabic, and men went down there from Europe and got someone to translate for them from Arabic into Latin. And that's the way they got Aristotle's writings. And of course we can get to the original today, so that often they misunderstood Aristotle. But Aristotle had a very great influence at that time. Now we will continue and next week.